This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson, and we have a movie review from Matt O'Lean. But we are going to start today talking about a book I once read called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. And it was some years ago when I read this book, but the synopsis is that we can find that we have much in common with someone and be getting along splendidly until this. We find out that they just vote differently than we do. And all of the sudden, everything that we liked about this person, we question. And we hold so dear to this idea of identity and how it impacts our politics and our voting. And today we are joined by philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, and the upcoming episode of Why, airing this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, is on the concept of American democracy, and specifically, is it failing? Jack, thanks so much for joining us today.
I am happy to be here, and I'm happy to be the idiot to your rightness, basically.
What is democracy in its purest form?
Well, I'm going to start with an even easier question, which is, how do you answer that question? How do you talk about it? Because we can't have the conversation without stepping away from the things that make us angry. We can't have an answer to that question that says, democracy is a system that will elect Donald Trump, or democracy is a system that won't elect Donald Trump. We have to ask what the core values of democracy is. So, what is a democracy? A democracy is a political system that allows individuals to be equal, self-governing, and authors of the laws that they find themselves in. In other words, democracy is a system that lets individuals interact to be themselves and to be as much of themselves as the people around them.
And you and your guests distinguish a little bit between American democracy and other forms of democracy. Why?
It's very hard to talk about democracy without comparing it, whether you're comparing it to an ideal democracy that, like, someone like Plato would have talked about, or whether it's just how does American democracy compare to Belgium's democracy or Mexico's democracy. It's very hard to avoid that comparison. Also, it's really useful to remember that everything we decide upon was a choice. And so the founders chose one system over another. The founders chose one kind of constitution over another. We, when we decide on policies, choose one position over another. We can't talk about evaluating or ultimately healing the American democracy until we recognize that we play a role in choosing and that we are responsible, not necessarily for the outcome, but for how much freedom we have to find a desired outcome.
Your guest is Adam Lovett. He is a lecturer at Australian Catholic University and the author of Democratic Failures and the Ethics of Democracy. He's also studied in London. Why are you talking to someone who's not American about this?
There's a couple good reasons to talk to somebody who's outside the system, independent of whether or not the person has expertise or not. When you are outside of a political conflict, you can see things about the political conflict that people inside don't see. When you are evaluating something as a whole, it's important not to get trapped into the parts. And I think, as you mentioned in introducing this segment, anyone who is investigating American democracy right now is going to be colored by their loyalties and colored by their fears, and they're going to direct the conversation, at least subconsciously, to a conclusion that justifies their position. So sometimes when the conflict is tremendously intimate, having someone who doesn't have a horse in the race is the best way to get past the triggering moments and get to the core of the issue.
You and your guest spend a great deal of time talking about identity. What's the difference, Jack, between how we think political identity is formed and how it's actually formed?
We are educated about the democratic process incorrectly in school. We are taught that what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to examine yourself to figure out what your position is on controversial issues like abortion or gun control or Social Security or things like that, and then find the party that matches your position best. Then you become a member of that party. That's what we're taught happens. But that's not actually what happens. What actually happens is we are raised in a context in which our parents and our community identify with a particular party, and we start to think of ourselves as a member of that party first. My mom is a Republican, therefore I'm a Republican. My dad is a Republican, therefore I'm a Republican. My neighbors are Democrats, therefore I want to be Democrats. Now, in college or around your late teens and early 20s, we might rebel or learn things and change our position. But even so, we then identify ourselves as a Democrat or a Republican first. And then we want to act out that for other people. We want to ask not what position on an issue do I believe. We ask, what does it mean to be a good Republican? How do I tell other people I'm a good Republican? What would a good Republican vote for? Same for the Democrats or independents or things like that. There are people who absolutely identify as independents. They don't want to be bound by the traditional parties, so they're going to act out their independence. And so your identity as a member of the party is so fundamental that it tells you whether you are pro-choice. It tells you whether you are a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. The identity comes first.
When did that start happening?
Fairly recently. When the idea of democracy first came up, was floated in the classical Greek world, the idea was that the best method of being a human, the best role a human can be in is citizen. That is the highest good a human being can accomplish. And so a person would see themselves as an Athenian as opposed to a political party member, or a Syracusan or a Spartan as opposed to the party member. They were a member of the state first. In the 18th century, when the Constitution is being written, when Thomas Jefferson is figuring out the foundational philosophies, when he's arguing with Madison, there was still this notion that citizenship was a high ideal to strive for. But they also understood that a democracy is governed by ordinary people, farmers and shopkeepers and landowners and workers and all these people who are going to have to make decisions that they don't truly understand. So they created a party system to act as a shortcut for people who say, well, I don't really understand banking regulation, but I know that I'm a Federalist, so I'm going to choose that party. The further away we went from having the ideal of citizenship, the more we had to fill that void with something. And especially since the 1960s and 70s, we have filled that void with these identities that we all know very well, whether it's whiteness or blackness, or whether it's your religious point of view, whether you're a Catholic or a Buddhist, or whether you're, you know, think of yourself as a libertarian or something like that. These notions of identity eclipse our political identity because they are what we want to be judged by. And that's how we vote, because voting is first and foremost for us a performance to show other people what we believe in and who we are.
Is it possible to separate the emotional reaction to a specific policy from the policy itself? And the identity that we form around the emotional reaction?
It's possible, but it's difficult. And ironically, the more important the issue is to us, the harder it is to separate the emotional content. I mean, if someone is immersed in a debate about what kind of cutaway on the sidewalk do we want, you know, ramps or some other option that I don't even know what it is, I'm not going to care that much. But if I were in a wheelchair, if I loved someone in a wheelchair, if I had to deal with crutches every day, if my very existence every day depended on this kind of cutaway on a sidewalk, it would become really important to me. And I would get upset anytime I thought someone was taking away my freedom and my ability to move myself from one place or another. If I care really strongly about abortion, if I care really strongly about gun control, it's very, very hard to separate that emotionality. In fact, I've taught Introduction to Ethics for about 25 years. And when I did the final assignment where people could choose their own papers, I always said, you can do anything you want, but you can't talk about abortion and you can't talk about marijuana legalization. Because those two sets of papers were always horrible, because students couldn't step aside and look at it from a philosophical point of view. What Why Radio is trying to do with this episode, and what philosophers are trying to do in general, is figure out a way to talk about these deep-seated issues without triggering that emotional reaction. So instead of talking about affirmative action per se, we can talk about what equality means. Instead of talking about the Second Amendment and gun control per se, we can ask, what does it mean to govern oneself? We can step away and ask these abstract philosophical questions and hope that investigating those tells us more about our beliefs and more about our convictions and gives us more choice on how to choose. Because the thing is, if we are trapped by our identity, then one has to question how much freedom we have to vote in the first place. If I can only think of myself as X, Y, or Z, if I can only think of myself as a Democrat or a Republican, then I'm always going to vote that way. And I'm less free than if I have a philosophical point of view where I can really examine things, I wouldn't say objectively, but closer to objectively than I would get otherwise.
That's an interesting take on freedom that doesn't seem to square with current notions of freedom. That, you know, am I oversimplifying in saying that that freedom sort of seems to mean that I should be able to do whatever I want?
It is an excellent question, and it is something that I spent an entire semester talking about in one of my classes. What is the definition of freedom? And I'll give a very quick example. I grew up, as our listeners know, in New York City, where people are pretty much free to do whatever they want. No one will pay attention to you at all, but there's high crime and hostility and anger. I lived for a while in Vienna, Austria in the 90s, and there people were very critical and judgy and were always paying attention to everyone else, but I could walk home at 2 a.m, listen to my then Walkman, because it was the 90s, and I carrying my guitar, and I knew I wouldn't be mugged. I knew I wouldn't be hit in the head. Women could walk in the street and feel 100% safe, where they don't in many neighborhoods in New York City, or frankly, in certain parts of North Dakota. And so the question is, are you freer if you can do whatever you want, or are you freer if you're safe from violence and molestation? Right? What does freedom mean? Does freedom mean do anything you feel like without consequences? That's the American conception of freedom. Or does freedom mean you are safe enough and secure enough that you can realize who you are and act out who you are without getting, again, hit on the head? That's a much more European conception of freedom. So what freedom is incredibly complicated. And one of the ways that philosophers have tried to sort of make sense of that is by looking at both the rational or logical components in freedom and the emotional or intimate elements of freedom, and figuring out how to balance logic and emotion to get something that fully represents who we are, so that we can act the way that we want in accordance with the values that we hold dear.
Is it helpful to talk about concepts like a democracy and freedom in this sort of ideal state when we are dealing with the fact that humans are quite fallible and we manage to take things out of their perfect state pretty quickly.
That's also a really good question, and it's something that has plagued philosophy for 2,000 years. Are you doing ideal theory? In other words, are you comparing things to an ideal? Or are you doing non-ideal theory, which is you're looking at how the world really is? And I think that there's two sides of that coin. The first is looking at something as an ideal really helps us clarify our values. It really helps us ask what's truly important to us, and again, it helps us step outside our squabbles to get a sense of what we believe and what other people believe so that we can approach the conversation in a more informed and self-aware way. But at the same time, we don't want, and the expression goes, we don't want perfection to be the enemy of the good. And what that means is when it comes time to make decisions, we can't say, we're only going to vote for the perfect answer. We're only going to choose the perfect system because sometimes things can get a little bit better. Sometimes things have to go step by step by step by step in order to progress into something that we want. So if you have an ideal, and this is what revolutionaries and actually reactionaries do, but what revolutionaries do, they say, here's this perfect world. We're going to destroy the system all at once and give birth to this perfect system. We know that that does not have a long history of being successful. What we want instead is to have a goal in mind and take short steps along the way. You can't start running a marathon. You have to walk, run for a long time before you start running 5Ks and 10Ks and then half marathons. The perfect can't be enemy of the good. You have to be able to act even if you don't achieve that ideal.
It's occurring to me in this conversation that so much of what you deal with as a philosopher is what people in sort of the health and wellness end of things refer to as something called a scarcity mindset and an abundance mindset. Scarcity is this, you know, pattern that you can only focus on a lack. Is it possible that we are going into voting booths with a scarcity mindset or an abundance mindset, and that alone is what's actually impacting our ability to make decisions, whether it's for ourselves or for a more collective society?
If we take those terms literally, then that is absolutely what we're doing. And what I mean by that is politics is the process of allocating scarce goods. There isn't enough land for everyone to have all the land they want. There aren't enough cookies for everyone to have all the cookies. There isn't enough penicillin for everyone to have all the penicillin they want. We have to decide who gets what and how much because scarcity requires that we make decisions, that we choose between who benefits from the public financing or who benefits from the distribution of electric cars or what have you. So on the one hand, politics is all about managing scarcity. If there was enough for everyone to have everything they want, we wouldn't have to make any decisions. At the same time, there is a discussion to be had about what it means to vote as a citizen in a democracy. On the American system, we are presumed to vote for what we want, what best serves our self-interest. And we are supposed to think of ourselves and the people who are most important to us in the ballot box. This is the legacy, by the way, of John Locke, if anyone is keeping score at home. In the French system, for example, which is the legacy of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, another democratic thinker, what the French in a Republican mindset, and I don't mean the Democrat and Republican, I mean the sort of political system called Republicanism. In a Republican mindset, you're supposed to walk into a voting booth and ask, what is best for everybody? Not what is best for me, but what is best for the community as a whole. So if you take your scarcity versus abundance framework, you can see that in many regards, Americans very much approach with a scarcity mindset, and the French and European model of democracy is more focused on an abundance. Ultimately, I think if we're really going to take America seriously and the ideal of America seriously, we have to ask, is freedom something that is scarce, or is freedom that is something we can make abundant? Or in other words, can everyone be free at the same time, or does freedom necessitate that some people are free and other people's are not because there is a limited amount of freedom to go around? And I actually think that is what divides Republicans and Democrats to a large extent. At the core, their attitudes about freedom and how much freedom there is to go around.
You know, Jack, at one point in your introduction to the show, you talk about specifically not wanting to talk about the current state of the American political system and not wanting to talk about who's in office and who's running for office. And if you identify as a Democrat or a Republican and try to step aside and just think philosophically, and you say to the listener to be both curious and courageous. Why put those two words together? Why is it an act of courage to be curious?
One of the things that doesn't get talked about enough when we're talking about democracy is that freedom is terrifying. That to truly be free is to open ourselves up to two different things. The first is responsibility. If I am absolutely free, then I am the only one responsible for what happens. And I can't predict what happens because life is what happens when you're making other plans. You don't know if you're going to get hit by a car tomorrow or if you're going to win $1 million. You just don't know. And so freedom, when you take it seriously, is amongst the most terrifying things there is. Now, imagine turning that freedom inward or towards your ideas. What if it turns out that you're wrong about something? What if it turns out that you are a bad person? What if it turns out that you've been helping people, educating people, leading people astray your whole life when you were trying to help them? What if your values turn out to be evil rather than good? When you're genuinely curious, you have to ask all these questions. You have to look at yourself in the mirror. You have to look at the things that you hold most dear and have the courage to say, maybe I'm not going to like what I find, but I have to do it anyway. You know, I think about how horrible it must be to be a parent of someone who goes into a school and commits mass murder, right? How awful must it be to look at someone you love and see that they've caused so much suffering and so much pain? First of all, how do you still love someone who has done that? And second, how do you hold the responsibilities on your shoulder that because you are the parent, somehow you are accountable for this school shooting and the death of 10, 20, 50 different people? Parenting is terrifying in much the same way freedom is terrifying, because you are accountable and yet you are out of control at the same time. So I think that curiosity and courage are complementary. You have to be curious if you want to be courageous, but you have to be courageous if you want to be curious.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. The upcoming episode, Examining American Democracy, airs this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central, and there is a longer version available wherever you get your podcast. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure as always.
Still to come on Main Street, News Director Dave Thompson. That's after this.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We begin the second half of today's show with another one of Tom Ezern's Plains Folk Essays. In 1950, the Institute for Regional Studies at North Dakota Agricultural College was proposed, inspired by regional identity efforts in Texas and Oklahoma. Despite initial skepticism, Tom Ezern tells us that the Institute became the oldest regional studies center on the Great Plains, significantly contributing to the academic status and pride of the institution through collaborative efforts from a diverse group of faculty members.
In 1949, a new dean arrived to head up the School of Applied Arts and Sciences at North Dakota Agricultural College, not one from the customary Midwestern lineage for North Dakota Agricultural College appointees. The press said he was a native Texan, but his name didn't sound like it, Gustav Ernst Giesecke. If you read the notices further, you learned that he hailed from Marble Falls, Burnett County, in the central Texas hill country, and then it makes sense, since German immigrants figured prominently in the settlement of the hill country. The historian Fred Lubke wrote a wonderful book about them called German Seed on Texas Soil. The Giesecke family was a learned bunch and exceedingly German. The immigrant patriarch, Johann Friedrich Ludwig Albert Giesecke Sr., had a white beard that draped to his waist. It was when I found a photo of his son, Walter Christian Giesecke, the father of the future Dean Giesecke, that I commenced making historical connections. Walter is a dashing-looking German rancher with a devilish goatee and a stockman's brimmed hat, but a hat blocked in the style of a German country hat. The connection I grasped was how it happened that Walter's son Ernst in 1950 would found at North Dakota Agricultural College the oldest regional studies center on the Great Plains of North America, the Institute for Regional Studies. The Institute, still a going concern, will celebrate its 75th anniversary in the year 2025, and so I'm looking into its origins. Because I realize that the formation and persistence of this research center in North Dakota is part of a larger concern sometimes referred to as the regional project, by which I mean the instillment in the hearts and minds of people on the prairies of the sense that they live in a distinctive place, much larger than local, a continental region that came to be known as the Great Plains. Molly Rosen has written a fine book called Grasslands Grown that identifies the origins of a sense of place among girls and boys who grew up on the prairies a century or more ago, and tells how, as they went into the world, they met other prairie girls and boys and concluded their common experience meant something. To articulate and refine that experience into a regional identity was the regional project. And it required artists, writers, scholars to accomplish it. Indeed, the very phrase, Great Plains, did not enter common American usage until the Texas historian Walter Prescott Webb published his landmark book, The Great Plains, in 1931. The regional project, like the range cattle industry, arose in central Texas and percolated northward. Webb, and perhaps even more so the folklorist J. Frank Dobie, anchored the project at the University of Texas. The statesmanlike editors of the University of Oklahoma Press, Joseph Brandt and Savoy Lawtonville, gave the Great Plains voice on the other side of the Red River of the South. A generation later, Ernst Giesecke brought the regional project to the Red River of the North. This was after he had taken his degrees, culminating in an extremely esoteric dissertation in German linguistics at Stanford, completed a fellowship in Germany, served a wartime stint in the United States Navy, and held some previous academic appointments. To my knowledge, Giesecke, unlike Elwin Robinson at the University of North Dakota, who did, Giesecke never wore a broad-brim hat to the NDAC campus. But I do.
That was Tom Ezern. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and a longtime contributor to Prairie Public. Dave Thompson reviews this week's news. That's next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, producing reliable electricity for 141 member rural electric systems in 9 states.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
And that's Dave Thompson's walk-up music, if you will. Dave, it's great to visit with you. You are our news director here at Prairie Public.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be here.
It was nice to visit with you in person yesterday, Dave. Yes. But I have to ask you, as I was coming out of the parking lot at Prairie Public Studio in Bismarck, I see these new speed bumps that look to me like they've been installed, and I've asked some legislators about that, and they tell me it's to slow you down as you're racing over to the Capitol. Is that what that's all about?
I kind of thought that might be it.
Just some construction work going on.
Right, and they're replacing water mains. So for the last couple of weeks, I've had to go at 3 o'clock in the morning to a local gas station which sells spring water by the jug. Ah. I've had to buy some jugs of water to make coffee. So a small inconvenience.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Right,
Dave.
That's right.
Dave, someone said North Dakota's having its primary elections this coming Tuesday, June 11th.
Yeah.
And I'll note to our listeners, I'll visit with the Secretary of State of North Dakota, Michael Howe, and that'll be on Monday's Main Street to ask him whether or not the state's ready for this primary election. But what's the newest news, Dave, about the primaries?
Well, we've got a lot of people who are voting by mail, and now they're at the early vote centers. And I understand that they're getting a pretty good business, too. So North Dakotans are getting kind of anxious about this election. And there will be a lot of people who will come on the primary election day. But a lot of people are voting early, and that's not a bad deal.
How are you going to cover the primary elections, Dave? What will people hear on Prairie Public?
Well, we're going to be doing break-ins at newscast times, which will be top of the hour 8, 9, and 10. And we will have numbers, and we will have reactions as we get them from candidates who win or who did not win. We'll be working all night long on that.
And I'll note that the Secretary of State's office doesn't release numbers until polls are closed in the Mountain Time Zone over in that part of the state.
That is correct.
After 8 o'clock Central, Dave?
I would say that's right. And that's where we will get our numbers. We'll get our numbers directly from the Secretary of State's office.
All right, Dave, on to the news. The DOT has been researching the use of AI. That doesn't surprise me, but what's the latest there?
This interim committee met this week. It's an information technology committee. The DOT representative, Mike Gerhart, said, yeah, we're looking at AI. Now, that committee's been tasked with studying AI, and it's some interesting things that they're looking at AI for. Number one, to look at road conditions, to get a better start on road conditions. Looking at traffic management, there's a special thing going on, a research effort with UND on 12th Street in Fargo, and that's to make sure that you have better traffic control to try to reduce congestion. Plus, there's also the possibility that they'll use drones to take a look at, you know, overpasses, other structures, bridges, to see how they're doing and to see if repairs may be needed.
Technology is everywhere, including on our highways, Dave.
It is. And one other thing that I did not include in the story that I was kind of interested in, they're thinking at this point of putting fiber along the major roadways to help with the IT.
Dave, there's been an issue relative to crime increasing a little bit in Fargo, and now United States Attorney with federal law enforcement partners has announced this SAFER, S-A-F-F-E-R initiative. What's that about?
According to the U.S. Attorney's Office and Fargo prosecutors, since 2010, the population of Fargo has increased 18%, but in the past 5 years, violent crime has risen by about 45%. Current trends are now suggesting the increase may be leveling off, which is not too bad. But the U.S. Attorney's Strategic Office for Fargo through Federal Enforcement and Resources, or SAFER initiative, will help, you know, try to keep a lid on violent crime and to try to find ways to reduce crime overall.
Alarming to me, I guess.
It is a little alarming, but then again, we're talking about matters of scale, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Dave, the Transmission Authority director says there is potential for brownouts and blackouts because of new EPA rules. Is that something that might affect us here?
It is, because North Dakota still gets a lot of its power from coal-fired power plants, which are known as baseload plants. And the worry is some of the rules coming out from EPA about greenhouse gas emissions may cause some of those plants to close down unless they get into the carbon sequestration business. And they're worried they're going to lose a lot of the baseload. And then the power grids, and in our region it's MISO and SPP. MISO stands for Midwest Independent System Operator. SPP is the Southwest Power Pool. The worry is they're going to become more and more dependent on weather dependent sources of power like wind and solar.
Are these worries maybe down the road a few years, Dave, or are they present day?
I think they're probably down the road a couple of years, but there is some concern. And that's, you know, one thing, a story we talked about, a few months ago. The Commerce Department in North Dakota is now looking at nuclear as a possible solution to this. And there's a two-prong thing for that. We're going to be doing a story on this. Number one, you've got baseload. But number two, we have all these data centers coming into North Dakota. And Department of Commerce is out recruiting data centers coming to North Dakota, build them here. We've got a lot of space for you, and we want to provide reliable power. So that's why there's, you know, the attempt to look at what's happening in Wyoming. And you and I have talked about that. Wyoming is starting to embrace the idea of nuclear power.
And those data centers suck energy like
boy, do they ever, yes.
Dave, the University of North Dakota is continuing an effort to update its campus. And I'll tell you, as somebody who has come from Wyoming, I think their campus is beautiful. I really do.
You know, absolutely. And my apologies. I'm a UND alum graduating in 1978, but I haven't been back. And I haven't been back for a while. I haven't been back to see the new improvements on campus. One thing I did notice when I was up there covering something is that the old dining room we used to have really became more of a bistro type atmosphere, and I think that's very interesting.
I would like that.
In the quad where I had my dorm room, now they're becoming kind of like mini apartments because that's what students are asking for these days. So there's been a real effort in campus to update things, refurbish buildings that they can take down that they can't unless they put an awful lot of money into it, and then making some space for example, a STEM center. The STEM Education Center, which the old Hislop Sports Arena, for those UND listeners who remember the Hislop Sports Arena, is going to be torn down. And that's where the STEM building is going to go.
Just quickly, Dave, my old dorm at the University of Wyoming is scheduled to be blown up.
Blown up?
Literally.
Oh, boy, you remind me of something. I was in Moorhead when they blew up a building or imploded a building that used to be a dorm. That was really interesting.
Well, this is the largest building in the state of Wyoming, and just 12 stories of the old McIntyre and White Halls. And I will be there with a lawn chair watching and maybe shedding a tear or two whenever
I understand that. I definitely understand that.
Dave, the Board of Higher Education has talked about tenure again and FAFSA. FAFSA, of course, are those forms that families fill out when their kids are going to college. What's the latest?
Latest, let's start with FAFSA because the state got a federal grant to help students fill out their FAFSA forms. And this comes on the heels of a real problem. They rolled out a new, supposedly easier form from the federal government. Well, they had some problems and some students couldn't fill that out. So North Dakota has been working on this, and they've gotten a grant to help students who need help filling that stuff up. But the tenure discussion is going to continue for a while. And one of the board members said it very well. We're in favor of tenure. We believe in tenure. But what happens post-tenure? And that's the interesting discussion. Do you then offer tenure to somebody who's replaced a tenured faculty? There's going to be a long discussion on that.
Dave, what are you working on? What's coming down the line from the news department?
Well, I've previewed this a couple times, and finally, and as you well know, Craig, you need a little time to do some of these longer pieces.
Sure.
So I've got this longer piece on how Dickinson State University kind of lost the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. But the story does have a happy ending.
Dave, we'll look forward to hearing you talk about the news.
Gather around, everybody.
Dave Thompson. We review the news every week here on Main Street. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Craig.
More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
When you hear the fanfare, that means it's time to go off to the movies with Matt Olin. Matt, you've seen a recent film in the French language, but directed by Woody Allen. So I'm not sure if that makes it a French film or an American film. Coup de chance.
Yes. So this is on Amazon if anybody wants to see it. It did get a very small U.S. release. That was his first U.S. release of any kind in 7 years, as he's had a lot of difficulty, as you know, with his personal problems getting U.S. releases anymore. And his films have not been good, quite frankly, Ashley. This is the first Woody Allen film I've seen since Cafe Society in 2016, which was one of his worst movies ever, the star Jesse Eisenberg. But I can report this is his best film since Blue Jasmine in 2013. So what we have now is kind of it feels like a typical Woody Allen movie of the old school, the old days when he still kind of had kind of control over his screenplays and you know, his films were had a kind of a funny, lively air to them. And I think what helps here, Ashley, is it is in French. So it feels like a Woody Allen movie. You know, a lot of the situations are typical Woody Allen. Like there's this chance meeting on a street in Paris between Fanny, played by Lou Delage, and Alain, played by Neil Schneider. And they were former, you know, classmates in college, and they meet on the street. She's married. He's not. And you know what's going to probably happen. Her husband is played by Melville Poupeau, very good in this part. So it's really a three-way kind of triangle here going on. And it's Woody loves these kind of chance encounters. But I think what helps him here is it's the Paris setting, so we're not in New York. It feels like this is a more lively screenplay than he's written in a while. It's kind of funny, but it's also dark. There's some dark elements, kind of like Match Point, which was his tennis movie that he made in 2005. He's also got Vittorio Storaro shooting this movie. He is the three-time Oscar-winning cinematographer of Reds, Apocalypse Now, The Last Emperor. And you really see the Storaro kind of camera work flourishes at work here. So, but I think what really sells this movie is he's got attractive leads. They're all good in their parts. Yes, it's a Woody Allen movie. It's not going to set the world on fire, but at least it's competent. You know, his last few films, Ashley, Wonder Wheel, Rifkin's Festival, Rainy Day in New York, you know, barely got released. The last two did not get released in the U.S., and anybody who saw them, which was not very many people, said they were just almost horrible and unwatchable. I've said for years he needs a younger co-screenwriter because he's out of touch with really how millennials are and young people are. But with this movie, the two leads are so good, the younger leads, that it kind of saves him a little bit, I think, with kind of that out of touch that he's got. So it's good to see him back doing a reasonably good movie. And let me say, too, I prefer French actors in this movie saying Woody Allen lines than kind of his usual suspects. You know, Wallace Shawn, Tony Roberts, some of these people that have been in movies forever for him.
Gotcha.
Mouthing these New York Woody Allen lines. And also, we don't have one of his most crippling habits, which has been to cast a young actor like Jason Biggs in Anything Else and Jesse Eisenberg in Cafe Society, who are essentially playing a younger Woody Allen. They like jazz. They like Billie Holiday. They have nothing to do with millennials that you and I know. They're kind of extensions of Woody Allen. So we don't have that in this movie. So I like that aspect of it. It's not going to set the world on fire. It's not a great film, but it's dark and it kind of keeps you guessing as to what's going to happen. There is a mystery here and a mystery angle, kind of a what's going on, what's happening with this three-way love triangle, and kind of the darker things that play into it later, which I'm not going to give away.
Is it a meditation on marriage?
I don't know. I think it's a meditation on chance encounters and people meeting each other in life at the wrong time, which is the sense you get with Fanny and Alain. They met each other at the wrong time. Alain really likes Fanny. He's telling her, yes, I still like you even though you're married. What's she going to do about that? You got to watch the movie. So he likes chance encounters. I'm not sure it's a meditation on marriage, but it might be a meditation on people marrying for convenience. She's married to an older man in the film who's got money. You know, she's having regrets. You know where this is going probably, but even though we kind of know where this is going, there's that mystery aspect to it, I think, that really kind of keeps things moving along pretty well here.
Yeah, I mean, it almost sort of sounds like this classic conundrum of you can marry for stability or you can marry for romance, but
exactly.
You don't always
get them both.
You don't always get to get both. You know?
So at least this is a competent Woody Allen movie. You know, he's 88 years old. Maybe this is it. Wow. Maybe it's time to retire.
88.
But at least it's his best film since the Cate Blanchett Blue Jasmine in 2013, because since then it has been a steady stream of not just middling films, Ashley, but bad films. And, of course, the pariah status that he kind of has now in the United States, whether that's fair or not fair, and we don't have to get into that here, hurts his box office ability, which is almost nil anymore, to really move the box office needle.
Oscar trivia question for you today. The first French person to be nominated for Best Actor.
Best Actor. Maurice Chevalier in The Love Parade, 1929-30,
yeah. right? All right, yes. And got a second nomination pretty immediately for...
Was it The Big Pond?
Yep.
Yep.
All right, that was an easy one. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for June 6th. Leading up to the June 11th primary, we're celebrating democracy in action from North Dakota history, large and small. North Dakota is the only state without voter registration. It was abolished in 1951. In a story before the change, the Minot Daily News and Optic reporter reported on the local requirements. To be eligible to register as a voter, one must have lived in North Dakota for a year, including a six-month residence in Minot and 30 days in the precinct. In a 2015 review of North Dakota's voter registration history, the Secretary of State's office explained that the roster of registered voters was available for public review for 1 week, followed by a meeting at which eligible voters who believed they should be included on the roster or knew of people on the roster who should not be included could make a case to the board. Additionally, any eligible voter left off the roster who appeared at the polls was allowed to vote by signing an affidavit. Arguments for repealing voter registration included an analysis from a legislative committee stating registration was cumbersome and of limited effect. The repeal of voter registration passed with a unanimous vote in the Senate and only 5 dissenting votes in the House. Since the repeal, there have been a few notable efforts to bring it back. The first and closest effort was HB 1101, which passed the 1975 Legislative Assembly but vetoed by Governor Art Link. While North Dakota voter registration isn't coming back anytime soon, the legislature has approved numerous voter identification laws. In 2003, the legislature passed a voter ID law requiring every voter to show identification before receiving a ballot. In 2013, the legislature removed the affidavit system, and it also required Native Americans to identify a residential address. That provision was challenged in Brakeville versus Jaeger. The tribes and the Secretary of State settled the case in 2020. The agreement ensures that tribal IDs and tribally designated street addresses are valid. If you do vote on June 11th, you will need one piece of identification: a North Dakota driver's license, a North Dakota ID card, a tribal ID card or tribal letter, or a long-term care certificate. I'm Ann Ulquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
U.S. presidential candidates agree that health care is expensive, but their ideas for how to address it couldn't be more different. Our series, We the Voters, continues on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are so grateful that you joined us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, we'll air the next episode of The Middle, with Jeremy Hobson, who asks the question, how might the war in the Middle East affect your vote? And at 7 p.m., we'll have Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Monday on Main Street, we'll check in with North Dakota's Secretary of State Michael Howe to see whether he thinks our state is ready for the June 11th primary elections. Until then, we hope you enjoy the rest of your day and what looks like it will be a beautiful weekend here in North Dakota.